Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 117 of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I am Sari Kamen.
Sari Kamen in studio today. Two parts of the Pearl and Ash Machine. GM, man on the floor, Brandon McRill. And Somme Sommelier, wine person, beverage director, Patrick Capellio. Gentlemen, enter the studio.
Right on cue.
Awesome to have you guys.
Hey, guys.
So we'll chat with them. As they get comfortable in studio, we'll chat with them a little bit later in the show. But after the break, after we talk to them, we're going to debut our first installment of the Morning After quiz.
And I can't wait.
That's the name until I think of a better name.
I think it's a pretty good name.
But our little lab monkeys are going to be Patrick and Brandon for the Morning After quiz.
The first one.
The first
ever.
One ever. And I hope there are many more. But this may take the cake. It may savor the cake. We'll see.
That's an inside joke.
Yeah. No, that's a little hint as to what's to come. But first, Sari and I, we've got a lot of food current affairs on our mind.
We want you to know that even though this is radio and you can't see anything typed, current is spelled C-U-R-R-A-N-T, as in a current.
Not as in
current.
My favorite tabloid journalism of the 90s, A Current Affair.
Dun-dun. No, because this is food news. This is the premiere of A Current Food Affair here on The Morning After.
Sari, what's on your mind?
There's a lot going on, Jesse. I'm so glad that you asked. First of all, food trucks out, food hauls in.
Now, when you said this to me earlier, I was like, food U-Haul? That sounds like a truck.
No way. That's not what we're talking about at all.
Food hall, like a grand hall, a big space?
A big space, a place that offers a variety of food selections where one can go and choose amongst them, perhaps sample a little bit here and there. There is a bonanza of food halls opening. We've already had Gotham West now in the mix for a while over on the west side in Hell's Kitchen.
I want to know who goes there. That's so far away.
I went there
in my
once.
Opinion.
Yeah. Have you guys been there? Gotham West?
Never once.
Never once. Okay, well, not Brandon. Bergen, B-E-R-G apostrophe N, is set to open in Crown Heights next week in Brooklyn. That should be very exciting. That neighborhood is obviously rapidly changing and rents are rising.
Do you know what food joints are occupying that space?
No.
On the next episode of The Morning After.
I do know, however, that Hudson Eats down in the financial district at something called Brookfield Place, which sounds very corporate-y.
That sounds like the mall I went to growing up.
It does sound like a mall. Yeah. There's a Black Seed Bagels there. There's a Parm. There's an Umami Burger. So they're bringing Brooklyn into the financial district. Smorgasburg obviously now has up to 5 locations. And word on the street is that Anthony Bourdain is planning his own street market, and it's going to be all about different types of authentic street food, which is pretty exciting, and that sounds really awesome.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, so everyone's excited about that. I'll know no word on when that's really happening. I wanted to mention that it was Julia Child's birthday this weekend. She would have been 102. So let's all...
And still cooking.
And still cooking. She's still cooking up there in the sky.
Something like that. Happy birthday, Julia.
Happy birthday, Julia. Some news right up your alley, Jesse Kiefer.
And I want to bring Patrick and Brandon into this.
Yeah.
This idea.
You guys, please, feel free to chime in. A wine dealer, a well-known wine dealer, his name is Rudy Kurniawan. Maybe you guys know him.
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
So he's been sentenced to prison for 10 years for wine fraud.
Which is not murder.
Which is not murder.
Which is not assault.
And yet it's still a crime. Apparently, this guy was selling unbelievably expensive wine bottles to wealthy clients. They thought they were getting a grand cru or whatever. Turned out to be a grand con, because he was making his own wine labels, fake wine labels, and just kind of mixing bottles of whatever he had and selling it off as wine that would have otherwise it's cost a lot of money.
I have absolutely no idea how he could successfully just create old wine flavor that didn't just taste like vinegar. If he's like mixing
wine.
Well,
it must not have tasted like vinegar, but
Have you opened a bottle, have a bottle of wine open, like some wine open for like, you know, maybe a day? Does it taste that good the next day? Some of it, yes.
Well, some of it can,
I have an amazing palate.
It depends on the wine.
And clearly these people didn't.
Patrick, what, I mean, you've dealt with a lot of high-end wine. What do you, I mean, what is your take on this?
I mean, I know Rudy. When I used to work at Veritas, he would come in and I drank some good wine with him. At least I thought. it's sad. I mean, it's sad for our industry because there's already concern with where wine comes from and how it was stored. But now to add an extra element with whether or not it's real or not, I think makes it extraordinarily scary, especially for collectors and also, you know, wine buyers. It's a big problem. It's very sad, and you know, it's unfortunate, and it's going to be a while before we bounce back and recover. And I think people can confidently buy wines with age on it, and especially in the kind of wines, you know, there's specific wines that we're aware that were kind of created by Rudy, and
like Petrus, like some DRC.
Yeah, those are two big ones. Yeah, yeah.
I don't get the impression that this is like a widespread problem.
Well, counterfeiting's been around forever, so yeah, it's a big problem. I mean, thankfully and not thankfully, I guess we know about. I mean, it's not good that we don't know, but it exists and has existed for as long as wine has cost money. It's like anything. You know, when you go to Canal Street, you can get Louis Vuitton bags, and the ones you're paying $10 for are probably not real, but.
But you're kind of aware of that. Now, I guess my initial reaction, and I'm glad you said that, you know, this hurts our industry, because that's a better way for me to think about it. But kind of I was thinking like, oh, you know, it's just rich people who are using this high-end fancy wine as a status symbol. I don't feel that bad for them. Is that a shitty way to think?
I think so.
Yeah, I mean,
they just because they have money doesn't mean they should get ripped off.
You're right. That's, you're
yeah,
right.
That's I just said I supported you unconditionally, but I do take that back because I actually don't agree with you on this.
It's fair. That's
people should. I mean, there should always be a level of honesty and trust when you make a purchase. You should, no matter what your financial situation is, if you're purchasing something, you should be getting what you think you're.
What you think you're getting. Yeah,
and if it costs a lot of money, there's more reason that it should actually be authentic.
Yeah,
I think.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I see my Modelo is arriving. Hang on one second. I'm going to go get it.
Modelo delivery.
the Modelo truck has arrived.
What's your other topic?
I have one other thing. It is a food story because it involves ice, and we all know that to some people, ice is food. I want to comment on the ALS bucket, ice bucket challenge that's been going around. I don't know about you guys, but my Facebook feed is nothing right now, but a bunch of people I went to high school with dumping ice on their head.
I just saw something amazing. If you're on Instagram and you don't follow Levy Dalton, you should follow Levy Dalton. Levy Opens Wine is his Instagram tag. I can show you guys if you want. He just was drinking a bottle of wine, had a bottle of wine. It's pretty amazing. I wish that we're on radio, right? So
yeah,
people can't see
radio.
This. But
yeah.
So he basically has a bottle of wine open sitting down. And as he normally does, takes a lot of photos of bottles of wine. But he shot this video where he had the bottle of wine there. And then he's dumping a bucket of ice. You're seeing it right now. How great is that?
The wine accepted the ALS bucket challenge.
Yeah, dumping the bucket.
I just want to say out there to all my homies who are listening, if you want to go ahead and dump a bucket of freezing cold water on your head, fine. I don't care what you do. But don't do it because you think you're like a philanthropist. And, you know, I'm not like a party pooper. I know what you guys are thinking, whatever. But, you know, if you're going to do that, like, make sure you're also donating to this cause. Because it's shitty when people are like, I could donate to this cause or, like, dump ice on my head, so I'm going to dump ice on my head. Like, that's not cool.
Donate it and take the pain. And also think about...
Or just donate, whatever.
Well, think about what if this was going on when it's, like, December and it's, like, 0 degrees outside.
That would take some
how,
real balls.
You know, how philanthropic would you feel about dumping a bucket of ice on your head?
I have an opinion about it, and it's that I think that it can be dangerous to trivialize something that's such a serious subject. But at the same time, I was actually looking into it this morning because I was thinking about the trivialization of it, and I saw that their donations are up 1,000%.
That's great.
1,000%. So, and I saw also a video this morning of Bill Gates, who was he was challenged by Mark Zuckerberg, and then he in turn challenged Ryan Seacrest, and also I think Mark Zuckerberg challenged the former or the current founder or his partner in Facebook as well. And if you think about it, yes, those people probably didn't cut a check, the people who are watching that, but there are many people who will. And the exposure is going to be ridiculous. The amount of money they're going to be able to raise as a byproduct is incredibly powerful. And so, yes, it is. They're making maybe light of something that shouldn't be made so light of, but at the same time, like, there is going to be some serious revenue generated. So at the end of the day, that's what we're trying to do.
You know? Good. Yeah, I like that.
I agree with that. I did read about the point, how it's getting exposure, and that matters more than, I mean.
The point is, if you dump ice on your head and don't donate, you're a dick.
Definitive statement, Sarah Kamen on The Morning After.
Seacrest out.
Do we have any more topics, or should we take a break and get down to this Pearl and Ash business?
Let's get down to it.
All right. This is The Morning After on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
You are listening to Basilica by The Hollows.
Change is coming. Around the bend, shotgun wedding, and a story penned about a bishop who gave up his soul to feed a girl from the finger bowl. Next time you step up for the intention, remember most the great distinction between your life. Stories told about the deeds that made you old. Oh, shatter me, sweep me up into your hands, then scatter me with the seeds upon your lands. Oh, burn me down, let me wear your golden crown. So when I meet Saint Peter, I don't let you down.
Since 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods guaranteed to produce the very best-tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
And we're back here on The Morning After. Both of them have storied careers in the food and wine world. Alinea, The Modern, Tribeca Grill, Veritas, and now Pearl and Ash. All of these opportunities have paved the way for them to appear here on The Morning After today. Welcome to the show, Brandon McRill and Patrick Capiello.
Excellent pronunciation.
Thank you.
Wow.
Yes.
Thank God. You should be thankful you don't have Carla Rzuski on your show. That's
a
hard one.
I have had Carla Rzuski on my show. Somehow
that's a bitch
easier
to say. Really?
Somehow easier than anything with the ski at the end seems
that
easier
works
to me than Italian sounding names.
Italian sounding names. More Italian names.
I don't want to assume. You never know.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in Chicago, and I grew up in Phoenix, where no one has Italian sounding names.
You grew up in the two whitest parts of all the United States.
Well, I don't know if you can call Phoenix that anymore.
Oh.
Or Chicago.
However, yes, I will say there were a lot of Smiths in my world.
Yeah.
In my world. Well, you guys have been, doing the Pearl and Ash thing for a year and a half now. I want to know, how have things progressed? What have you, what's been different since day one?
Who you need to address us one at a time, because otherwise we're just going to talk over each other for the entire hour.
That's fine. We want to get it out.
That's how it works.
All right. Well, I guess let's go Brandon, because Brandon kind of got in on it first. You and Chef were putting it together. That was your plan to open from the Bowery House into Pearl and Ash, correct?
Well, close. Yes, there was a.
You tell me your story.
A bit of a detail in there, and that's that it was originally another restaurant, and that was called the Bowery Kitchen, and it was opened up in the summer of 2012, open for 3 months, and it was. Being put together by our business partner, Alessandro Zampedri, who owns the building that Pearl and Ash is located in. And he also runs the hostel, which is in that side of that building as well, which is called the Bowery House.
Okay.
And then the space became available. It was originally a restaurant supply shop, and they didn't want to renew their lease, so they turned it into the Bowery Kitchen. They ran it for 3 months. They weren't really happy with what they had, so they closed it down. Richard came in and helped them reopen Pearl and Ash 1.0, which is a restaurant that not many people know about, not many people have been to. And it was serving, I think, 5 whites and 5 red wines by the glass, a small low ABV cocktail program. It had about 10 dishes that were between like $5 and $12 that were all small one bites. And this was the restaurant that I walked into when I got there. And Richard was running the front of the house as well as the back of the house.
Oh, yes.
And he was just kind of pulling his hair out because that's hard to do for one person to handle all that. So I came in to help him and relieve some of the stress and pressure of doing that front. And then after being there for about 2.5 weeks... I sat down with him and asked him what he wanted to turn it into, what he thought it could evolve into, what he thought it could be, and he had ideas, and I said, well, let's do that. And we sat down and talked to the owner and said we want to do that, and then we closed it down and then reopened it 6 weeks later as Pearl and Ash 2.0. And it was Patrick came in between those two periods of time.
Okay, got it. So from the 2.0 beginning, how have you guys seen the Bowery progress? Patrick.
As a block?
I mean, there's a lot there now.
It's funny. I think it's funny because, I mean, I lived in that neighborhood I live like 5 blocks from the restaurant. So that's my neighborhood. So the idea of working in a place and owning it or whatever and being only 5 blocks from my house was like the most appealing thing ever. And although I will say that was the one block that if I was in the West Village or Soho or anywhere outside of the Lower East Side walking back home, that particular block would be the block I would never, ever walk down because it's by far, it's probably the worst block left in Manhattan. I mean, even Hell's Kitchen, like some of the worst blocks are all better now. But Bowery between Spring and Prince or Staten and Rivington is the worst block. We have the Bowery Mission right across the street. There's a huge amount of homeless people and drug addicts that live literally on our block, on the street, not actually in the buildings on the block, but on the street. And it's a challenge. It was a challenge now, or it was a challenge then, and I think it's becoming more of a challenge because as the surrounding blocks are evolving, this block is the one that hasn't yet evolved, although there are rumors of people like Steven Starr opening like next door to us, and supposedly the Ace Hotel has bought the Salvation Army building across the street. So in the future, that actual block looks like it will blow up. But it's really been more about what's happening a few blocks away, like Bacchanal opening with Scott Bryan, who was my old chef from Veritas, which has been hugely successful and I think a really great place for food and wine. And then Estella, which is just up on Houston. So it's been happening slowly but surely around the area, but that particular block has stayed true and the same. It's a challenge for us. I mean, we call the police. We know the Fifth Precinct real well. They're friends of ours, those guys, because we're on the phone with them all the time trying to get people away. Last night, I got a text message at like 1 a.m. from Corey Lane, who was at the restaurant drinking all night and left and took a picture of a guy literally asleep in front of Pearl and Ash. And it was pretty funny, but it happens. It adds to the charm. I will say that.
Well, yeah. And you're also close to all restaurant supply. So you never have to go, ugh.
Yeah.
I gotta go get more silverware at Balder.
No, we have an account.
So
yeah, they know
away.
Us. They know us there too.
We just walk in and carry out. It's good.
Yeah.
Which is a benefit that most people in the restaurant world in New York City
don't have. And to play to what Patrick's talking about, actually, it's going to get even more interesting because we're opening up an outdoor patio soon, hopefully before the end of this year. So that will even make it a little bit more of a contrast of, you know, different styles of people out on the street. So we'll see what happens then.
Right in front?
Yeah, it's going to be
right
great.
Right in front.
You can drink Grunker Burgundy and catch second-hand crack smoke. It's going to be perfect for
anybody
who really wants to get their buzz on.
Good parents.
Rudy never thought about putting that.
No,
in there.
I don't think anybody did.
The ultimate embodiment.
That's how you keep them coming back.
The old and new Bowery, right there.
100%.
Yeah.
I mean, there's parts of me that hope that it doesn't change.
Yeah, I mean, too those much. People that were really pissed that yeah, you know, like CBGB's change. Now John Varvatos, or
it's yeah. something else. I think it's a Patagonia store now.
CBGB no, is John Varvatos.
Yeah, it's a John Varvatos. Okay. Yeah.
And they maintain the walls and they kept the existing floors and the ceilings, but it's like they took out everything else out of there, and you could still tell like they tried to maintain it, but at the same time, like it's not
going
to
be the same.
Well, but those that doesn't mean once you go above house, I recommend hanging out at your patio.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think it'll be fun.
So, but how did you guys kind of like back to what Jesse was saying? The way that you conceived 2.0 and it opened, has it changed or has it stayed pretty true to the way you guys envisioned it?
I think so. I mean, of course, every restaurant every restaurateur that's smart knows how to evolve as time goes on. But on my side, on the wine side, the wine program has changed immensely. I mean, we opened the restaurant with a 200 bottle wine list, which I was working out of Eurocovs, essentially. We had a 900 bottle inventory, and it was like reorders every day. And, you know, it was pretty intense experience right out of the gate to keep that program alive. But it was a lot of, you know, attention paid to the 200 bottle wine list on the Bowery. We're now just about to cross over 2,000 bottles a year and a half later. We've renovated the cellar twice. We now have a 10,000 bottle capacity in the cellar itself. Plus, we work with an offsite storage that has just as much. So
almost too soon.
Yeah.
So you have an online wine buying addiction.
Well, I mean, I you know, for me, it's just the statement I made about the wine program Pearl and Ash was my idea behind it. The philosophy behind it is pretty simple. It's not based on any region or any winemaking technique. Like, yeah, we have a lot of natural wines, we have a lot of classic wines, we have a lot of old wines, we have a lot of young wines. But the philosophy for me with the wine program was, I want people to be able to come to the restaurant, no matter who they are, no matter what their wine experience is, no matter what their budget is, no matter what their particular desire that evening is, to be able to have many bottles that are enticing to them. And I think there are many restaurants that, I mean, it comes from even going to restaurants and like being pissed that I can't find something that I'm actually in the mood to drink. Mm-hmm. But, when you're a sommelier, it's different. You're very moody and you're like, there's a whole diva complex that comes with being a sommelier. Like, oh, this wine list sucks because they don't have enough, natural Syrah from the Ardesh. Like, I mean, how many of those wines do you need?
I only say that because I just every time I said that
shit's allocated. Okay.
But so the idea was to try and, I mean, I look at it like, the more you make people excited about buying wine off your wine list, the more they're gonna buy it.
But what about the flip side to that? Like, what about the people who come in and find 1,000 wine list intimidating and then they don't know how to navigate?
Well, that's why you have sommeliers on the floor, and like that was me for a long period of time, and I am still on the floor, but I now I'm lucky enough to have two really brilliant young ladies that are on the floor, Kimberly Livingston and Bryn Berkheim, who are my two somms and are amazing young ladies. They were both waitresses when they started out at Pearl and Ash, but I think that I saw the potential in them, and they had the desire and the work ethic to want to make it happen. And now they've become really great sommeliers. And so they embody my philosophy of being a sommelier, where ideally you don't want to piss off your guests like that. Like, don't be a dick. Like, that's always the thing that I say to them. Like, be nice to people, help people find the bottle of wine that they want, listen to their desires, and give them a bottle that's going to make them excited about their experience.
I also think that you can take the methodology of the wine list and extrapolate it across the entirety of the restaurant to say that it is about approachability and access. And if you haven't read something about the place that says that it's a fun, relaxed place where you can go and have good food and good wine at a very approachable price point, then when you walk in the door, you see what's going on there. You look at the smiles on the people's faces who are A, sitting in the seats, and B, who are working in the restaurant. Instantaneously, if there was any sort of preconceived, intimidation, I think that would get washed away. And if it doesn't get washed away when they walk in the door, by the time they sit down and they hear the music and they see the livelihood of the restaurant, then it definitely gets washed away. So by the time that they open up that 1,600 reference wine list, it's like there is nothing but calm at that point. Everybody's just relaxed. Everybody's just having fun. And nobody has to worry about anything anymore.
Nobody's ever complained about how big the wine list is. I will say that. I mean, that'd be stupid. Why would you say, there's too many selections? I hate this guy for working so hard to give me so many options. What a douche. I don't think that.
I think a diner is smart to walk in and feel comfortable like that and say, okay, I'm just going to ask them. That's exactly. The moment. Instead of saying this list is too big, just like
there's really nothing better as a diner than having a sommelier like totally nail it for you.
Yeah,
like hit your sweet spot in terms of what you want to spend and then how you want it to taste. It's just
and being able to have a friendly dialogue with them.
Yeah, exactly.
And feeling comfortable.
Yeah,
and having fun with it.
And it's a process. I mean, you know, when they first started, you know, because they weren't sommeliers by trade, it was like a big issue with like bottles coming back that they were recommending that people weren't into. Mm-hmm. But my statement was, no problem, take it off the check, go back and do it again, make it happen. So there's a learning process that happens in there. But I try to be. The goal was to try and make them comfortable and make them excited about the career they've chosen and giving them the opportunity to figure it out, like learning on the floor. So I think that is the best. And you know, now I've become so much a fan of that. Like I have sommeliers from all over the world that want to come and work at Pearl and Ash as sommeliers, but I'm like, you know what? I'm super happy with what I have. I have two people who get it and are a big part of the culture. And now we have, you know, four people that are waiters that are volunteering their time working in the cellar and interested in the opportunity of becoming sommeliers as well. So I'm super lucky that I have people that are passionate about the idea of working in the wine industry and want it, but have no preconceived notions. Like they didn't buy wine before here and they don't need to rattle off the resume of whatever, because that stuff doesn't matter to me. And more importantly, it doesn't matter to the guests. They don't give a shit where you worked before. They want to drink a great bottle of wine and they want you to be nice when you recommend it.
Brandon, your approach to just front of house service in general. I mean, Sari and I read a little bit about you on Eater, where when you got the job, I think at Alinea, you were interviewed and they were like, they said something like, you know, do you cook? And you're like, no. Do you like read about food? No. How do you feel?
Do you know
Thomas Keller is? How do you feel about that now as someone who's opened several restaurants?
But then they were like, great, you don't know anything. Perfect, you're hired.
It was Joe Catterson, who was the opening GM at Alinea and also the wine director, and he was interviewing me, asked me this litany of questions, which I said no to everything. And I had no business being there, and I had no business. I didn't know where I was or who I was speaking with at the time. And I just said no, because it was the honest thing. And he...
How old were you?
I was 22.
Okay.
And he passed Grant in the hallway leaving that interview. And when Grant had come in behind him and interviewed me, and then they were crossing paths again, and Grant looks at him and goes, this fucking guy? And Joe goes, trust me. And I think that what he saw was that I was going to do anything that they said, however they said it, which is exactly what I did. Is because I didn't know anything about fine dining. I was serving pizzas before that in cargo shorts and dropping buckets of beer and dropping pizzas. And then I was working at a 26-course tasting menu with an 18-course wine pairing, and check average was about $250 a head. So they're like, this high. I was like, okay, run this fast. You got it. Like, and that's, there's something to that. It's a similar methodology of like in the Army. You know, you bring them in when they're 18, train them how you want to train them, do exactly what you want to do, and it's disciples, but it's for the right reason, because the impetus behind it is to make something good. Not do what I do because I say it, do what I do because it's the right thing. And we have hired the majority of the people who work in the restaurant at Pearl. I think we've got a lot of that similar methodology. It's like bringing in people who are like, I am super excited about what you guys are doing, but I haven't worked in a fine dining restaurant before. I don't know a lot about food. I don't know a lot about wine, but I'm a nice person. I'm an honest person. I'm a hardworking person, and I will put forward the effort to make it so that I do good at this. If I can get that out of every single person, I can turn them into being very successful within the business. So it's teaching them about food, teaching them about wine. Education is everything, but on top of that, and what's even more important for us, is culture and impetus. It's nothing to do with execution in any way, shape, or form as much as it is about culture and impetus. Why do you do what you do? You do it because you want to do a good job. You do it because you like serving people, because you're friendly, because you want to talk to people, because you want to integrate with people and show them world-class food and world-class wines, and that gets you excited why you're doing something. That's what people take note of. They see that passion, and it absorbs into them, and it helps them have that experience that's different than a lot of places that you go to, where people are just focused on, did I put the fork in the right place? Did I set the wine glass down in the right place? Where the watermark is in the right spot? People don't care.
Yeah, I mean, Brandon did a good job of the. And, you know, it, for me, it's funny because Tribeca Grill was the same philosophy. Like Marty Shapiro was the GM there. It's very similar to Brandon in that way. We hire so many people who have zero New York experience. When I first moved to New York, it was like you couldn't get a job anywhere without 2 years of a restaurant experience. Like, that was the normal. Like, and I'm like, why the fuck would you want... That's the worst thing you could do is have a waiter who worked in New York for 2 years. I mean, after 1 year, a waiter's an asshole. After 2 years, like, they got to become the worst person. And the resume's a mile long. All the places they worked at, they don't give a shit. They think they're super important. I mean, you're not doing anything that's that important. But most of our staff are like right off the boat. Like, it's fresh off the boat, like, for sure. Like, I'm sometimes amazed, like, how many times I have a conversation with people, they don't even, like, know how to get to the restaurant, like, on the subway.
I think I can't take credit for it as much at this point either, because I haven't been interviewing or hiring people in the restaurant for about the last year. It's actually Mel Feckman, who's the manager of the restaurant, that's been isolating all these people. And she herself is, like, one of the most kind, outgoing, like, gracious, friendly, good attitude, high-spirited individuals that I've ever met, and she's the one who can pick that out of people. So she sits down in front of people, and she recognizes what she sees with those qualities in herself and other individuals, and she brings them in, and then she develops them and curates them into these, like, incredible hospitalitarians.
Just only hire people from Ohio and you'll be good.
Yeah.
Ohio and Michigan, yeah. Illinois, Indiana.
Apparently. Like, that's that, like,
well, that's not me. I'm not taking credit for that either.
We have more female employees than... Like, it's got to be 7-1.
Yeah, I think probably. I don't know why.
On the wine team, there's one poor dude, James, who's like this poor guy.
Is it really poor if you're the only dude?
I don't know. I think that's intense to work with them.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like they're hanging out at a club. They're working at a cold-ass wine cellar. I'm sure that poor guy gets beat up.
It's really nice to hear, because I do feel like there was a trend. I mean, I don't know. I don't go out to that many fine dining places, but... There was like a period of time where it was like, why are there no women working in
It's definitely
in
male-dominated industry at the super high end. Not that we are, but...
Yeah, it still is.
It's weird.
It still is. So aside from what's happening actually inside the restaurant, I think you guys are huge social media people. You've really, like, of most restaurants' feeds that I follow on Instagram, like, you guys are really on top of that. I just want to know, you know, what results do you see from social media?
And do you do your own social media?
Personally, I do my own social media. Brandon is his own. Pearl and Ash, we have someone who runs it. Only because I feel like it's enough work to handle my own. I try to be, my approach is always to be, like, you know, kind of short and sweet on it and, like, drive home the initial point, but don't be overwhelming with it. And I think that's the, most people who are in social media, I think, often can maybe oversaturate their feeds. So for me, I try to keep it, like, simple and just, this is what's going on, or this is what I'm passionate about today, and kind of let it go at that. But I mean, I wasn't on social media. I'm actually not even on Facebook. I'm kind of not the kind of person that likes to be out there. It's not hard to believe, I guess, but I'm a very introverted person as a whole. I don't really like to be out there. So I was working at the hotel, at the Nerd Palace Hotel at Gilt, and Raj Parr approached me and he said, dude, you have this amazing wine list, but nobody knows. And nobody knows because you're not talking about it. I'm like, well, I tell all the time. I tell people all the time. He's like, yeah, but these people are already here. You have to tell people who aren't here. And the way you do that is with Twitter. And then Mike Madrigal, who is also super influential and who is also, I think, probably one of the more, like, Raj and Mike are really the best at it, I think. So they both pushed me a little bit. So I jumped on, and I was already on Instagram earlier than that because I like photos, so I was taking pictures, so then that kind of evolved. But yeah, I mean, it's the result is great. I mean, I get people to come from all over the world who are like, I follow you on Instagram, and it's always the awkward moment where they say that and I'm like, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, like, when is the moment where that's not awkward, you know? Yeah. Like, I've been Googling you.
Yeah, it's, yeah, but it's great. It matters, obviously.
I think it's very, very interesting because people, they love walking into a place where they already know stuff about what's going on, and you can do that with social media. Like, you can introduce somebody to something before they've ever been there, and they're going to walk into the restaurant first time, and they're going to see Patrick and Kim and Bryn and Marshall and Mel and Richard and Eric and some of the waiters, because they're on the feeds all the time too, and they're going to be like, we know all these people. And it's like, you walk in and instantaneously you're already family. Mm-hmm. Like, you're walking into somebody's house, like, you already know all the people. Like, you're comfortable because you sit down and you're like, hey, Marshall, hey, Mel, hey, Patrick, hey, Bryn, hey, Kim. And it's like, we've never met before, but I've seen you guys on Instagram. I've seen you guys on Twitter. I've seen you guys on Facebook. So great to meet you. And then everybody's like, you know, their demeanor is instantaneously just friendly, welcoming, and it's just it just makes it for a much nicer experience. And then they share it with people. And then you can showcase it to people who've never seen it before, which means you get more people coming to the restaurant. which you can showcase then all the, you know, all the hard work and effort you've been putting forward. So I think it's a really nice thing. Plus, it gives us the opportunity, which we do a lot, to go out and promote and support people that we really love what they do, which is probably, if not, it maybe is as important as you know, kind of promoting our own stuff. But it's like, it's great to be able to give that over to other people as well, to say, this is what we think is really good. These guys are really doing a good job. You should check this out. I mean, I think we can influence people that way as well.
Yeah, I think you don't often realize the power of it until you hear the feedback. Like, yeah, I mean, you know, there have been wines that I or like Raj or Mike or Levy have gotten excited about that we've all kind of just promoted, and then like to hear like a couple months later that the wine is now like allocated. Like, I go back, I'm like, oh, I'd like to get some more of that wine. They're like, yeah, it's all gone, and I'm like, what? Like, yeah, maybe you should stop putting photos on fucking Instagram. And so that now it's become almost like a backlash where I'm nervous sometimes about like really blowing something up. But I get psyched when we get like cool shit that I like to pour by the glass or like to drink, or you know what I mean, like allocated stuff that I feel proud that we have and I want people to know. But we'll post something that we have, and people will come in, and within
gone in 2 days.
Within days, it's gone. Yeah. So it's pretty cool.
It's really helpful with you guys with Instagram too, because like the way that your menu is set up, that you know the ingredients are listed, but sometimes it's hard to see the visual to you know, to understand how the ingredients actually pair up together,
right?
So like to have the photos with it can be so enticing,
yeah,
because the ingredients are kind of like a little esoteric or a little mysterious. It's almost like a puzzle, and then you see the photo and you're like, oh yeah, I definitely want to see how that is working.
The menu is definitely developed to be provocative and like thought-provoking and make sure people are, it's a little bit of a figure it out, come in and kind of test it out.
Yeah, it's almost like a riddle.
Yeah, yeah, a little bit. And Richard's very good with technique. So, mm-hmm. You know, he's had some great mentors. He worked for Wiley. He worked for Paula Brandt. He worked at Key in Australia. So he's had some good experiences as well. So his techniques they're on point.
Yeah.
So
let's take a break here on The Morning After. I want to come back and talk about danger.
Let's do it.
You are listening to Young Bud by The Hollows.
I hopped over the mountain about 1,000 years ago. The city called me, mama told me, boy, you gotta go. More than a stone's throw away. Since that day, my best friend has been this road.
Hey, my name is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Severa Magazine, and I am hanging out at the coolest, most delicious place in the world, heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back here on The Morning After. Before the break, I said I want to talk about danger. And when I say danger, I mean sabering. You guys call yourselves Sabertown USA.
It was not us, though.
It's a hashtag that was created by... by two regular clients of ours, Dean Santon and Brian Garcia, a.k.a. Rock and Roan and Core Quarter on social media.
I have seen those. That's weird. I know your Instagram feeds,
yeah.
People.
I don't know. It was one random night where, I mean, sabering happened for me. There was a client that used to come to Veritas by the name of Bruce Fingerit. And Bruce was a champagne collector like no one has ever seen. He had more great champagne. Actually, Mike Madrigal and I worked his, like, 50th birthday together, and it was the most insane, like, disgusting thing you'll ever see, like, champagne forever. Mm-hmm. But he used to carry a saber around with him in his, like, wine bag, and he would saber, and he would get, like, you know, girls suited at the bar, and, like, and, I mean, so I had done it many times there. He used to leave a saber in the wine cellar at Veritas. So I learned how to do it then. I didn't really reemerge until the closing party for Guilt. So when Guilt restaurant closed, Justin Bogle, my old chef, and I did a farewell speech on the bar, and we had a magnum of Dom Perignon, and I sabered it, and then we ended that night. Then when Pearl Ash opened, I don't know, it was kind of like fresh on the heels from it. So it was the New York Times party. So after Pete Wells gave us a really amazing review, and you know, it was a pretty celebratory night. We had been open for not that long, and had ups and downs with reviews. And you know, I think it was really the review that I feel like Mr. Wells really understood what we were trying to do, and did a great job of putting it out there for everyone in the world to see. And so we were obviously in a celebratory mood, and I had a Jeroboam of Pierre Peters Cuvée Reserve, and I got up in the bar, Richard and Brandon and I did a speech, and I sabered it, and then like it just hell ensued. We just kept sabering, and then more accolades came, Bon Appetit, like top 50, and many other accolades that we received. So we would have parties all the time. It was just like this crazy shit show there. And we'd always saber. I remember like the Bon Appetit top 50 party. It was like all the editors from Bon Appetit were there, and had them all sabering. We were instructing them how to do it. So it became kind of this thing where people started doing it a lot often, and people started doing it on social media. So these guys were like, they invented that hashtag #SaberTimeUSA. And then now everyone seems to use
that. That sounds dangerous.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
Thank you for that.
Sorry. I didn't realize that was coming, so I would have set it up a lot better.
Okay. It's my job. It's fine.
So the art of sabering, can you walk us through that? Not everybody may know how to
I don't know if
this.
It's an art, but I mean, Pascaline does it. It's an art. Like, okay. Pascaline Lepeltier is the most beautiful sabering I've ever seen. When I do it, it's like a hack job. I have this giant fucking katana sword, and like, you know, I just smash the bottle. And the girls have become really, really great at it. Like, to watch Kim do it is pretty phenomenal. And Brynn, too. They both do an amazing job of it. But so the idea is the bottle is under pressure. You're just cracking the top of the bottle, and then the pressure is pushing out everything. It's really all it is. But you have to be careful. Like, there's a video that Matt Ducker shot for Bon App with me instructing people how to do it. So I always refer people to that. If you want to know how to saber a bottle of champagne, I think I did a good job because I wasn't drunk when I was doing it, which normally that's the case at the restaurant. So that was the most sober, and we did like a lot of bottles. So that tutorial is the best way to know how to do it safely. But yeah, you have to be super safe.
Like, you have to aim it in a direction.
Away from all your friends, please.
And all the candles, as Jesse pointed out, have a lot of candles in the restaurant.
That's fun for me, though. I try and kind of knock shit off the wall sometimes. In that direction, like breaking glass is fun when I can break. I mean, Brandon doesn't love it, but I think it's fun.
I mean, I think the most dangerous part of sabering I've ever seen is when a drunk person picks up a sabered bottle and goes to drink it.
I've done that before, yeah.
I've seen
the party
like
ended
people do that.
Real quick when I sliced my lip and blood was gushing everywhere. Everyone was like, all right, and I'm out. See ya.
Well, Patrick and Brandon, I want to give you our first ever The Morning After quiz.
All right.
You guys ready?
Yeah.
You guys ready? Speaking of sabering.
Do it.
This is in honor of one of my favorite NPR shows, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. They have a segment called Not My Job, where they invite people on and ask them questions that have nothing to do with what they do. So in the honor of sabering, Patrick and Brandon of Pearl and Ash, you know a lot about sabering bottles of bubbles, but what do you know about saber-tooth tigers? Are you guys ready for this challenge?
Yeah.
It's only three questions.
All right, I'm ready. Let me drink some more Modelo here.
Yeah, that'll help. Do what you need to prepare yourself. Then you can crush the quiz.
Mm-hmm.
All right, first question. Which of these names is the correct way to refer to these saber-toothed felines? Is it A, saber-toothed cats? Is it B, saber-toothed pussies? Is it C, saber-toothed tigers?
Saber-toothed pussies. Jesus.
Brandon.
I'm going to say A.
You're going to say A, and yeah. You would be correct.
Woo! That's lame.
Well done. Well done.
Being correct is stupid.
Being correct is for pussies.
Totally. All right. Question number two. What is the most likely theory of extinction for these long-fanged kitties? Is it A, the Ice Age, cats hate to be cold? Is it B, like all cats, they were picky eaters and starved to death when they couldn't find their fancy feast? Or is it C, their famed teeth were scary but lousy in a fight and they were wiped out by bigger beasts?
I'm going to go with C.
Go with C from Lousy Teeth.
I'm going to say A again.
You're going to say A again, and you would both be wrong.
Oh, jeez.
The most likely theory of extinction is that they, like, ate all of their preferred prey, and then they refused to adapt to kill anything smaller. Or most likely they, you know, couldn't eat enough to maintain their weight and die.
Those cats
they're like the
bitches.
honey badgers of cats.
No, I mean, if anybody's ever had a cat, the cat is like, oh no, I'm not going to eat that. You need to find me something.
I need some kibble, bitch.
So, yeah, they've definitely evolved from saber-tooth kitties. All right, and the last question. For all the money, exactly. The most well-known saber-tooth cat was a resident of North America. Where was the largest collection of fossilized saber-tooth cats found? Is it A, the La Brea Tar Pits? Is it B, the Mississippi Riverbed? Or is it C, Mount St. Helens?
I'm going to go with tar pits. I'm going to try and look smart for once here. I'm going for the right answer, I think.
Patrick says tar pits.
I'm going to say C.
You're going to say C, Mount St. Helens. Patrick, you are correct.
Yes!
The La Brea tar pits.
That's right. That's it. I always go for one out of three.
Yeah, it looks like you both got one out of three.
Wow, it's a tie.
You know what?
You guys both win.
We should saber something.
Fuck yes.
I wish, yeah, we probably could.
Did you guys bring your swords?
Well, you could shotgun those beers, too. I mean, that could happen.
Yeah, we got to get fresh ones if we're going to shotgun. This is half empty.
Is it legal to bring swords on the subway?
I've done it. Yeah, it's, you know, if we've took the saber to go.
Don't get caught.
A few times. And even when, because the saber we have is not small. It's pretty big. So I have a bag that conceals it real well. But I would imagine it wouldn't be good if I got caught with that thing out.
Yeah.
It's a weapon. It's like...
It is, yeah.
3.5 feet long, just the blade. It's like...
Don't take it to the airport.
Like, I swear I only use it on bottles. I only use it on defenseless champagne bottles.
You'd be convinced, but I would imagine...
Well, Patrick and Brandon, thank you so much for being on The Morning After and playing along with my saber-tooth tiger game.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, for
really
real.
Great.
Thanks,
so
guys.
Much fun.
Give us a shout-out to your Instagram feed, website, all those, Twitter.
We will do. We had a great time.
All right.
No, tell us what they are.
Yeah, don't tell us what they are.
Give us a shout-out. I'll tell you where we are.
We're pearlnash.com.
Roll it out.
Give us a shout-out.
It's actually not... Okay.
Pearlnash.com for the restaurant.
Yeah.
And mine is at Brandon McCrill, so it's just my name.
Pearl and Ash is actually Pearl and Ash NYC for Twitter and Instagram.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
And you're Brandon McCrill.
Yeah. And that's correct.
My Twitter and Instagram is Patrick Wine.
Patrick Wine.
Are you going to be dumping ice on your head anytime soon on your Twitter feeds?
Are you challenging me to do that?
I'm not. I have not yet been challenged.
You know what?
Nobody challenged me.
I'll take care of that in 24 hours. And how much do I have to donate once I do that?
The right amount.
That might take more than 24 hours, but I would love to be able to donate.
You should donate it to The Morning After, though.
Sari, it's been a great day.
Always is with you.
I'll see you next week. This is The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.